We're going to look at Matthew, chapter 5, beginning in verse 33. It's just a few verses in your pew Bible. We're in page 1503, if you want to follow along what Jesus has to say here. He's been talking about what it looks like to build your life on the gospel, and how that's different from legalism, from religion. And he speaks quite directly at times. Beginning in verse 33, the words of Jesus himself. Again, you have heard that it was said to people long ago, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you have made to the Lord. But I tell you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it's God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. Simply let your yes be yes, and your no, no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Vows. Is that what this is really about? That's certainly how it presents itself. Jesus saying, don't make a whole lot of vows. Just say what you mean and mean what you say. Why was he saying this? Because within Judaism at that point in time, there was an attempt to fix our tendency to hide, our tendency to not be honest, to not have integrity, to say one thing and then do something else, to address that with rules. The rules would be that if you swear by Jerusalem, then you can't break it. But if you swear by something less, maybe you can break it, just not on the Sabbath. And if you swear by something really little, then you don't really mean it. And the idea is let's put some policies and procedures onto this baby so that we all become honest. It's very similar to what we do today with a promise. You know, if you tell your child that We can't go get ice cream now, but tomorrow after school, we're going to pick up ice cream. And your child looks at you and says, do you promise? What has your child just told you? Mom, Dad, you have a history of failing with integrity. You have promised, you have told me that we would do things in the past, and then you have not followed through on them. Therefore, I am trying to apply a Jewish kind of regulation, some policies and procedures to this thing that you have just told me that I don't know whether I can really believe it. So I'm asking you to promise. Because a promise you have to follow through on. But just saying we'll go get ice cream, that could tell you a total lie. That's how we think. That's how we operate. It's the exact same thing that they were doing with oaths, with vows. And Jesus is saying here that the real issue is not the oath. The real issue is not the vow. The real issue is not these rules and regulations. They can't really address the real issue, because the real issue is integrity. Integrity, that oneness as an integer, that singularity where what you are outside lines up with what you are inside, with what you say lines up with what you intend. Jesus says, let your yes be yes, and your no be no. Anything beyond this is from the evil one. So what is integrity? Certainly integrity includes honesty, but it's actually more than that. We're, in terms of honesty, we all have habits of lying in one way or another. 86% of Americans admit to habitually lying to their parents. 75% admit to habitually lying to a friend. And 73% admit that they habitually lie to their spouse or lover. Now you say, Greg, that's not me. Honestly, Greg, I always am honest. So we've got an experiment this morning. You can do it now or you can wait till you get home. But I want you to take out your driver's license. And if it's a Missouri driver's license, towards the bottom middle, there are three letters, WGT, and then there's a number, usually three digits below that, at least if you're 16 or older. Those three digits are your weight. And we have nurses in the back after the service with very accurate scales if you want to test your integrity. The fact of the matter is, with some of you, if you drank what you tell your doctor you drink, you would weigh what you told the license bureau you weigh. It's just, we're all liars. Now, don't feel personally targeted. It's human nature. The Bible says we're all liars. There is none righteous, not even one, so don't worry. But how many of you men have a driver's license that says that you're 6 feet? Statistically, it's the most common height on driver's licenses, even though most of us are 5'10". I'm actually 5'8", but that's with shoes on. But, you know, the fact is, if you're 5'11", what do you say when you pull out that car? I'm 6 feet. You know, it's human nature. It's all of us. And integrity is about lining up of the inside and the outside. It touches on things like flattery. Oh, hon, you're so marvelous. You look gorgeous. That was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. That's such a great coat. Oh, my gosh, have you lost weight? You're gorgeous. Yeah. Meaningless. Empty. And it makes the real compliments, when you have them, seem hollow and unbelievable. Psalm 12, with flattering lips and a double heart, the evil speak. That double heart of being one thing inside and the other outside. So, Proverbs 26, a flattering mouth works ruin. 1 Thessalonians 2, Paul says, we never came to you, Thessalonians, with flattering speech. We came with integrity, with the gospel, with nothing more. Jesus says, let your yes be yes, and your no be no. Doesn't mean you always say what's on your mind. Scripture says to only say that which is encouraging, meaning you're supposed to say, you know, there's that category of things that are true, and that category of things that are actually loving and encouraging to others. And it's the truth in love, that overlap of the Venn diagram, that's where communication comes into play. And it doesn't mean you expose everything about yourself to everyone you know. You know, there's levels of intimacy that are appropriate with various kinds of relationships. But the point being that the outside you and the inside you need points of connection. They should line up. Integrity means that you say what you mean and you mean what you say. It means you don't represent yourself as something you're not. It's the state of being whole and undivided, acting consistent with your convictions, whether or not anyone else is looking. It means being honest about your motives, honest about your concerns, honest about your thoughts. My own life, I did an assessment, kind of one of those like pastoral, how are you doing kinds of tests that you go through, battery of various tests. And this assessment of me decided that I was incredibly gifted. Brilliant, very quick-witted, with a very quick mind, good speaker, good on my feet, a good leader. And the weakest point on my assessment was integrity. It's not that I lie, not that I lie much. I mean, it's pretty rare, actually, that I lie. I mean, I actually get flushed when I do because I feel embarrassed and shocked that I did it. But integrity isn't about lying. That's just one little corner of this big block called integrity. Integrity means, well, it can mean a lot of different things. But for me, what it often looks like is that I am very, very, very professional and diplomatic. I can look at a situation and I can know what it is, what words I can say that will get the results that we need in order to get the church where it needs to go. And completely hide the real me and what I'm really thinking. I was born, raised in the D.C. area. I was a politico in high school. You can take the boy out of Washington, but it's really hard to get Washington out of the boy. That's something only Jesus can do, and he's been working on it for quite a while. But, you know, selecting words for effect, you know, massaging them, shaping things, spinning things to make something that you think looks ugly look beautiful. You know, I remember a counselor, you know, when I was trying to figure out what I would wear on Sunday mornings, and I was like, well, you know, I could do the black robe because that's tradition and that would, you know, line up with what other pastors do, or I could do the khakis and the open collar shirt, you know, kind of say I'm trendy and relevant and I'm just like all of you, or I could wear the business suit that says I am the leader, or I could wear the suit with, you know, the top unbuttoned and the tie pulled down a little bit to say, I'm a leader, but I'm really approachable and relaxed. And you don't believe that. You see how worked up I can get. But, you know, it's, as a mask, it doesn't always fly. But, you know, the counselor's like, well, what do you want to wear? And I get so used to the mask and what do I need to project to get the job done that I forget to even ask, well, what is Greg Johnson like? Where's my voice in this? Is the outside the inside? Are they lining up at all? I remember another conversation where with another pastor out in West County, and I was talking about some sacrifice that I was weighing that I thought I needed to do, and you know, for the sake of the church, for the sake of the ministry, for the sake of the mission. And he said, well, where's your voice in that? Because I'm hearing you talk all about the church and the mission and all this ministry stuff, but I'm not hearing you yet. Putting his finger on that issue. Am I too used to hiding behind a mask and maybe even becoming that mask to the detriment of my own soul? I mean, it's why my cat has a Facebook profile. That's actually not an integrity problem. That's actually part of the solution, because if Greg Johnson had a Facebook profile, then every time I see a cat video about cute little Sphinx kittens getting their first bath, I would hesitate before I said like. Because, well, Memorial Presbyterian Church, does Memorial Presbyterian Church support giving baths to newborn Sphinx kittens? You know, I would have to totally get rid of my own personality. I don't want to become that. I've done that. I don't want to be that. I want to be me. And so ironically, even though some people call Facebook fakebook because there's so much posturing, for me, it's actually an outlet where I can actually be Greg Johnson, even if it's Lila Toiger, Greg's cat, in parentheses. You know, I don't want to be two-faced. Being two-faced, one thing in one context and another in another context with little overlap between the two. You know, the canonical example of this, the most political example, is one I shared years ago. It's one that David Jones shared with me. It's from 1952, when the Mississippi legislature was deciding whether or not to legalize distilled spirits for beverage consumption. And one member of the legislature, Noah Soggy Sweet Jr., gave his speech. He stood up before the legislature and he said, "My friends, I have not intended to discuss this controversial subject at this particular time. However, I want you to know that I do not shun controversy. On the contrary, I will take a stand on any issue at any time, regardless of how fraught with controversy it might be. You have asked me how I feel about whiskey. All right, here is how I feel about whiskey. If when you say whiskey, you mean the devil's brew, the poison scourge, the bloody monster that defiles innocence, dethrones reason, destroys the home, creates misery and poverty, yea, literally takes the bread from the mouths of little children. If you mean the evil drink that topples the Christian man and woman from the pinnacle of righteous, gracious living into the bottomless pit of degradation and despair and shame and helplessness and hopelessness, then certainly I am against it. But if when you say whiskey, you mean the oil of conversation, the philosophic wine, the ale that is consumed when good fellows get together that puts a song in their hearts and laughter on their lips and the warm glow of contentment in their eyes. If you mean Christmas cheer, if you mean the stimulating drink that puts the spring in an old gentleman's step on a frosty, crispy morning, if you mean the drink which enables a man to magnify his joy and his happiness and to forget, if only for a little while, life's great tragedies and heartaches and sorrows, if you mean that drink, the sale of which pours into our treasuries untold millions of dollars, which are used to provide tender care for our little crippled children, our blind, our deaf, our dumb, our pitiful, aged, and infirm, to build highways and hospitals and schools, then certainly I am for it. This is my stand. I will not retreat from it. I will not compromise." Jesus says, "Let your yes be yes, and your no be no." Chuck Swindoll says this. He says, "Integrity is completeness or soundness. You have integrity if you complete a job even when no one's looking, if you keep your word when no one checks up on you, when you keep your promises. It means the absence of duplicity, and it's the opposite of hypocrisy. If you're a person who has integrity, you'll do what you say. What you declare, you'll do your best to be. Integrity includes financial accountability, personal reliability, and private purity. A person with integrity doesn't manipulate others like a politician or somebody raised in D.C. He or she is not prone to arrogance or self-praise. Integrity even invites constructive and necessary criticism because it applauds accountability. It's sound, it's solid, it's complete. It's the freedom to take off the mask that we wear, the mask that says, hey, I'm happy when I'm sad, the mask that says, I'm better than most people, I've got it together, I'm self-sufficient, I'm competent enough, I don't need love, the mask that says, I'm the expert, I'm the theologically trained professional, the mask that you put on when you're feeling insecure or abandoned that says, I'm not hurt, when inside you're absolutely crushed, the mask that says, I'm independent, I'm cool, I'm a good person, the mask that you put on when a key person doubts your motives or doubts your trustworthiness that says, hey, I don't really care what you think, when inwardly you care immensely about what that person thinks. We all wear masks, and integrity is the freedom to take it off. Why do we wear masks? Well, it's because we feel a need to hide. In his book, True Face, Bill Thrall gives the account of a guy named John. He says, John fashioned an elaborate mask shortly after he graduated from Arizona State University back in 1975. John hadn't given much thought about his future. He had just assumed it would come knocking at his door. And as May neared, his classmates started telling him about their soon-to-be-launched careers in companies like IBM and Xerox and Fidelity Mutual. His friends had secured real, actual careers complete with salaries and benefits. And after bragging about their bright futures, his classmates would invariably ask, so, how about you, John? What field are you going into? Well, I'm keeping my options open. I've got a lot of brands in the fire, and I don't want to bite at the first thing that comes along. In truth, John had nothing in the fire, but admitting that felt way too risky. So he made two significant decisions. First, without telling anyone, he moved to Isla Vista, a small beach town near Santa Barbara, California, a town where no one knew him and where those who did couldn't find him. And secondly, he wrote to everyone he knew, and he told them, hey, guys, I found a gig in Isla Vista. I can't believe it. I'm the featured weekend comedy act of a nightclub named Borsides. I've worked up a bunch of new bits, vocal kinds of stuff. Just a couple of Saturdays ago, a talent guy asked the manager if he could use me a couple nights in L.A. Well, stay in touch. I'll write more later. I've got to work on tonight's show. In truth, Isla Vista did have a nightclub named Borsides. John just made up a few of the surrounding details. With that letter, John fashioned a mask that he thought would protect him forever, would protect him from his friend's pity above all. The trouble is, it didn't work. And after 4.5 years, it had actually become a part of his identity. After a while, the mask began to deceive even John. The lie rolled off his tongue so easily that it began to believe it was part of his history, that he actually had been a comedian at Borsides. And when he describes that time in his life, he says, you know, I could see the smoke-filled room and the hurricane lamps at each table. I could see the light spilling onto the stage with a stool and a mic that sent my voice out into the dark sea of smiling faces. I could hear the audience's laughter. I could smell the beer. Now, that is a mask. And unknown to John, his mask was actually thin as sketch paper. People saw right through it. Years later, he asked a few of his best friends, hey, did you believe me? Did you ever wonder if I was actually working stand-up comedy? And one of them said, you know, we never talked about it much. We just loved you. We figured that if it weren't true, it probably wouldn't help for us to blow your cover. Yeah, I guess I never really thought you were doing stand-up. Wow. John had told himself that he had wonderful hip clothes. Hey, I thought my friends were proud of me. I thought they believed I was someone significant and famous. And yet it was a waste of energy and soul. Some of you might be hearing this thinking, man, I'm glad I'm not like John. I'm glad I'm not lying to people like that, making up stories and almost believing them myself. That's messed up. I'm glad I'm not like John or like the Notre Dame coach who lied on his resume, or Yahoo CEO Scott Thompson, who was forced to step down for doing the same, or Walmart's chief spokesman, who was fired for lying about who he was, or Brian Williams, who was suspended from NBC News for dishonest statements he made about a 2003 news event, or the solar company Solyndra that misrepresented facts in order to secure a loan, or the Christian leader Ted Haggard, whose ministry collapsed a few years back after it came out that he was living a double life. You know, it's all of us. It's our instinct. We wear a mask. because we feel a need to hide, or we feel a need to get things done, or we feel a need to be someone. Maybe it's our shame we're trying to cover up, or maybe it's that we desperately long to be loved and we think, you know, maybe if I wear this mask, they'll love me. And yet you don't stop and think that, no, they won't. They'll love the mask. And you will be more hidden and more concealed than ever. You will be known by no one. You will be completely alone. And the turmoil and the pain of it will only increase because they love the mask. And you're unknown. Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything else is from the evil one, the one who is a liar from the beginning. Augustine, St. Augustine said this back at the end of the 4th century in a treatise on lying. He said, the biggest victim of deception is the soul of the one doing the deceiving. Whence also the heart of him who lies is said to be double, speaking of James's double-minded man, further shattering a soul already injured and lacking wholeness and integrity. What is it that makes a giant ship move across the sea? But engines, massive, powerful engines. But what is it that keeps the ship afloat? The integrity of its soul. The integrity of its hull. So how do we gain it? If integrity means the lining up of outside and inside, taking off the mask. If we wear masks because of our shame or because of our need to be someone or looking for love, how do we gain it? We gain it through the gospel that Jesus is presenting in the Sermon on the Mount, where he begins talking about that, how those who are spiritually bankrupt, the poor in spirit, those who have no righteousness of their own, are the very ones that God chooses to bless. Where he talks at the end about asking and seeking and knocking on God's door, because he will open the door, he will answer, he will come to you, he will be found. Who talks about building your life not on the sand of religion, but on the rock of Jesus Christ and his gospel, living out that identity as one who is already loved, who doesn't need to measure up because Jesus has measured up for me, who doesn't need to be successful because Jesus was successful in my place. And I can just be honest and try to love and use what I've got without building some identity or righteousness of my own. The gospel, see, addresses the sin beneath the sin. You know, why is it that you feel a need to lie? If it's to save face, the righteousness of Christ, the approval of God, covers your shame and gives you a robe of righteousness. Is it because you need to advance your career? You're already of ultimate significance in Christ. That's the sin beneath the sin. It's taken away. You don't need to be significant. You already are, and nothing you're going to do is going to enhance the resume of Jesus Christ, which now has your name on it. The gospel gives you an unshakable foundation from which you can risk integrity. You can risk removing the mask. You can risk letting people see you and know you as you truly are, because you are loved, because you are safe in Jesus. And yet the gospel does something more. It also gives us an environment of safety in which to develop true integrity. It's called the church. The gospel says that all of us are far worse than we realize. I think I'm bad. God knows I'm worse. And yet he loves me and delights in me and covers over my sin and actually is happy with me because of what Christ did for me. It means I'm more loved than I could imagine. There's nothing you can do to make God love you more. There's nothing you're going to do that's going to make him love you less. He's already completely committed to you. The church as a community built on the gospel gives an environment where what Stephen talked about can happen, where you can be real about your brokenness without somebody shunning you or despising you or judging you for it. You can have an environment where nobody's shocked by sin, where there's no anger or shame or blame or competition or condemnation, but complete acceptance and love and embrace, because we have the gospel and we are accepted. A community where you don't feel a need to be guarded or to hide or to hedge what you say, where there's no combativeness, where they don't immediately try to fix you, where they're not going to gossip about you, where they're not going to pressure you or ask you to fake it, where there are brothers or sisters who are there to hold you up and not carry you down, a community of grace where you can show your true face to other people, safe and protected and honored, where God is right there in the midst of that, maturing us together. This is what the gospel creates, a kingdom. Legalism just patches over it, saying, well, just make promises, just make vows. Jesus says, no, just have integrity. Just be honest. Just take the mask off and be who I've made you to be. Flaws and all, you're fallen, that's okay. I cover you with my righteousness. I delight in you now, and I'm giving you a family of people who are all in the same boat, who are just as jacked up as you are, and yet who are just as loved and just as safe and just as secure. There's a book called True Faced, and in it is a story of two different ways of doing Christianity, two different rooms that the author walks into. The first one he calls the room of good intentions, of trying to do the right thing. And the other he calls the room of grace. He says the room of good intentions is about striving to work on my sin so that I can have a relationship with God. He says, as I enter, the hostess asks me in the room of good intentions, hi, how are you? And as I begin to share about my struggles with sin, everybody in the room gets quiet and they begin staring at me in shock. And the hostess places her finger on her lips and she says, shh, as she hands me a mask just like the others wear. The room of good intentions is a room in which everyone is fine. Everybody's just fine. How are you? I'm fine. I'm just fine. And you? I'm fine. Hanging on the wall behind them all is a banner that reads, be ye holy as God is holy. And Bill says, I'm going to give this room all I've got. And he stays there days and months, and weeks turn into months. And then he begins to notice how cynical everybody is, how tired they all look on the creases around the mask. The room of good intentions, he finds, is stifling. And the more you give to it, the more it breeds insecurity and duplicity. And the mask at this point is becoming so tight, it's hard to breathe. And so he sneaks out of that room, and he heads for the next room. Desperate for help, he begins slowly to turn the doorknob. He writes this. He says, as I step inside, another hostess immediately approaches. She smiles kindly, and in a voice that's once knowing and reassuring, says softly, welcome to the room of grace. I answer tentatively, well, thank you. She presses, so how are you? And the room grows quiet. Well, I've been here before, he says, and so not to be duped twice, he answers, I'm fine, pretty fine. Who wants to know? And the room stays quiet. Gun shy from the first room, I interpret their silence as judgment, and so I yell out in a rage, all right, listen, I'm not fine. I haven't been fine for a long time. I'm tired, I feel guilty, lonely, and depressed. I'm sad most of the time, and I can't make my life work. And if any of you knew half of my daily thoughts, you'd want me out of your little club right now. So there, I'm not fine. Thanks for asking. I reach for the doorknob, he writes, to leave and hear a voice from far back in the crowd. That's it? That's all you've got? I'll take your confusion, guilt, and bad thoughts, and I'll raise you compulsive sin and chronic lower back pain. Oh, and I'm in debt up to my ears, and I wouldn't know classical music from a show tune if it jumped up and bit me. You better have more than that puny list if you want to play in this league, boy. The greeter smiles and nudges me to say, I think he means that you're welcome here. Emboldened, I smile and I call back. Do you struggle with forgetting birthdays? He walks right up to me all the way from the back. He puts his hand on my shoulder and says, birthdays? I can't remember my own. Everyone in the room laughs with a warm laughter of understanding, and I'm ushered into the fold of a sweet family of kind and painfully real people. There's not a mask to be seen anywhere in this room. As I walk further into the room, he says, I notice a huge banner on the back wall, and this one reads, standing with God, my sin in front of me, working on it together. I think, wait, that can't be right. How can that be? It sounds presumptuous, careless, imagining God with his arm around me as we view my sin together. Come on, surely they've got it wrong here. I've always been told that my sin is a barrier between God and me. And if it could be true that God actually stands on my side of the sin, standing with me in front of my sin, well, that would change everything. If that were true, God has never moved away from me, no matter what I've done. Oh my gosh, I'd have to rethink everything. It says, despite my doubts, I can't help but notice that in this room, the room of grace, everyone seems vitally alive. The people are obviously imperfect, full of compromise and struggle, but they're authentic enough to talk about it and to ask for help. Many have a level of integrity and maturity, love, laughter, freedom, and vitality that I don't recall seeing in any of the people in the other room. I feel the start of something I haven't felt in, well, as long as I can remember. It's safety, or something like that. Toto, he concludes, we're not in Kansas anymore. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this room of grace. I pray, Father, that all would freely enter and find in it the safety, the security, the warmth, and the love to live out your grace in their lives. Amen.